Coming up on Digital Music Trends 183, recorded on the 14th of May 2014, the angles on a potential Beats acquisition by Apple, a chat with the CEO of Yonder, Aphex Twin's Kickstarter, an interview with the CEO of Dubset, anti-piracy measures in Sweden, France and the UK, Spotify's reported bid for Last.fm before they acquired the Echonest, and much more. Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Music Trends. I'm Andrea Leonelli and this is the weekly show where we talk about and try to make sense of the latest news in the digital music industry. And DMT is available as an audio and video show on a variety of channels, including the iTunes Store, most podcatching apps. If you're on iOS, the podcast app is free. Or try out Downcast or Dogcatcher if you're on Android. Of course, YouTube for the video version, SoundCloud, Mixcloud, TuneIn and much more. And if you'd like to receive a weekly mail out from DMT on the latest show, so you don't miss any, the shortcut is bit.ly/DMTlist. And if you want to comment on anything that's happening during the show while you listen to it, you can tweet me on @DigiMusicTrends or email contact@DigitalMusicTrends.com. Welcome any feedback of any kind. And so this week it's a real pleasure to welcome back to the show Lucy Blair. So just come back from Spot. So hi Lucy, how's it going?
Hi, Andrea. Very good, thanks. Good to be back.
It's great to have you. And Darren Hemmings. So hi, Darren. How's it going?
Good. All lovely.
And Darren, of course, from Motive Unknown and also known for the Daily Digest, which you can subscribe to on motiveunknown.com, which is a great roundup of everything that's happening every day in the music industry and also in the sort of digital marketing side of things, if I'm correct.
Yes.
Am I correct?
Yeah, that pretty much nails it. I'll give you that one. Awesome. You've earned your tenner. Well done.
Nice. And no money is changing hands. I would like to stress that. And so this week we're going to have a couple of guests coming on. I've got a pre-recorded interview as well. But, of course, the story that ruled them all this week, and no, it's not the beginning of Lord of the Rings, but it's Beats Electronics and the supposed deal that sees Beats being acquired by Apple. So it was big news this week. It came out on Thursday, about midnight, actually. I was in a hotel at the Great Escape when I read the news, and then I started spreading it around like the good... busybody that I am, and so we have heard essentially everything, every single angle around the story ever since. You know, there's been hundreds of articles written. Seems like everybody that has any connection to music or tech or hardware or anything like that has written a post about the Apple and Beats Music story. So definitely it's an interesting one, but I wanted to hear your opinion. And you know, in case you haven't heard about it, Apple would be acquiring, according to the reports of the Financial Times, Beats Music and Beats Electronics for $3.2 billion. This seemed to be confirmed in a video uploaded by Dr. Dre over the weekend, where he seemed to sort of boast about the fact that this was happening, although no official statement has been made at this point by either company. So it's essentially still a fairly weighty rumor, but we're not sure this is happening still yet. And I wanted to tackle it from three different angles. So the hardware side, the service side with Beats Music, and then generally what it means for the brand Apple. So starting on the hardware side, Beats sells a massive amount of headphones, so this is not a stupid move on Apple's part. You know, they do make a lot of money. But interesting to see whether Apple could apply Beats Music into their own technology and what they're developing for the headphone side of things and the wearable side of things. So, Darren, do you think that there is something there, that Apple could actually tap into the pre-designed range of headphones that Beats has already made and without having to spend all the money on R&D and actually integrate some of the tech elements that they developed for the wearable side of things into those headphones and make them even more appealing to the mainstream?
It's certainly possible, yeah. I find it a bit odd. I mean, there's a sort of degree to which, you know, I think it was on, was it on Malik? Somebody was writing about it and saying that they've outsourced the whole thing when they designed right. The Beats headphones. They were outsourced to a guy that used to work for Jony Ive anyway. So it's quite funny that they're sort of now buying a company that's designed products by a man, you know, who used to work under the chief designer at Apple. There's a sort of strange, circuitous thing about that. It's a bit puzzling, really, isn't it? I think it's probably the best way of summing this one up.
Absolutely.
It's a bit peculiar. You know, I think Beats are sort of, in Beats world, they're known for, like, you know, amazing quality headphones and all that sort of thing. I think to everyone else, they seem to be, certainly among the more cynical members of the public, they're sort of known for being somewhat looks over, you know, style over substance, I guess. Which isn't really Apple's thing, it has to be said. They're not really a kind of they don't do that. They're very proud of their high quality on their products and, you know, and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's, I think the reason we're seeing so much speculation in general is just that people are probably a bit puzzled as to the move. You know, it's, I think often it's like, you know, when Spotify buys Echo Nest, it's such a no-brainer that it doesn't really warrant any discussion. There's,
yeah,
there's nothing to discuss. It's kind of plainly obvious why they'd buy that company. But when you're talking about this kind of move, I think most people are just a bit bewildered. You know, Apple do design, clearly. They've, you know, they led the consumer market for high design products. So they don't, you know, they could certainly do this themselves. So I don't know. I mean, you know, I think I have to say, you know, my gut feeling on the whole just seems to be that maybe this is more of like the, you know, the world's most expensive kind of acquire, or however we term it, when, the, you know, that I think the money is as much for Dre and Iovine and co as it is for any other aspect of the business, because yeah. I don't think there's much else that Apple couldn't replicate themselves. You know, a streaming service is not beyond this company,
yeah.
And neither is a headphones business. But so it's curious, it's puzzling.
Lucy, on the hardware side, do you think that there's something there in terms of integration? And you know, do you think it makes sense for Apple to buy a company for this valuation that also has a business that makes money and, you know, is already has a cash flow behind it, right?
Yeah, I do. I mean, from that perspective, you know, the hardware business kind of paying for the stream music service, you know, you can see that that would kind of make sense for Apple. I think one of the interesting aspects that has been written about over the past few days is how this might sort of, this acquisition, assuming that it does go ahead, might transform the rest of the industry.
Right.
You know, there was another good article on GigaROM saying that, you know, we might get to a point where actually all of the big tech companies are going to own a streaming service, or are all going to purchase one, and then, you know, pure play music subscription services won't actually be able to compete anymore. They won't exist anymore, and instead we'll be in a very different scenario where, you know, music services are being bundled with, you know, hardware, with Amazon Prime, with headphones, you know, with anything else under the sun, really.
Yeah.
And the music subscription streaming setup that we know today actually isn't going to exist anymore.
Yeah.
So I think that that's actually one of the most interesting possible impacts of the whole purchase, assuming that it does go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it could be an interesting evolution of the digital music side of things. But at the same time, when we talk about the streaming service, which is Beats Music, it does make me wonder, you know, I've seen a couple of articles already that are stressing the fact that people that are interested in Beats should look elsewhere at this point and should look at something like Spotify if they want a service that they're absolutely certain, crystal clear, that it's going to be here in a year or 2 years' time. Whilst Beats Music now, it's a bit of a question mark, because if the acquisition goes ahead, we don't know what Apple's going to do with it. So, you know, Darren, do you think that Beats can fit within Apple as a streaming service, or does it make a lot more sense for Apple to just, you know, start from scratch? I mean, the other question mark is around licenses. We don't know whether Apple can actually continue operating the service under the licenses that Beats has struck with the labels, or whether those are going to have to be renegotiated as soon as the acquisition goes through. So lots of question marks here, and then I guess a bit of uncertainty for Beats Music consumers.
Yeah, I mean, I think the license thing, I've seen and heard kind of, you know, people calling that both ways, that
right.
The licenses are transferable and things like that. I mean, I think, to be honest, in my experience, the music business are not in the sort of, you know, they're not in the business of being vindictive around licensing, in that sense that, you know, they're not going to sit and go, what, you want to renew? Well, you can get lost, you know. They might just seek to get more money out of it. And, you know, certainly the years of iTunes playing hardball on stuff might come around to bite them on the backside. But I don't think it would be crazy. You know, the music industry is still not stupid. And,
right.
You know, I think that's the easy thing to forget is, you know, it's kind of as Lucy said, you know, there's a phenomenal power for these people to take a service like Beats and bundle it into iPhones and everything else, you know, that Apple makes, and suddenly you have a pretty strong proposition. Yeah, I mean, relative to Beats' model and where that leaves them, you know, would people rush to sign up? I don't really know. I mean, I still maintain the number one flaw in Beats' plan was that they just didn't have a free tier.
Right.
You know, if you can sign up for Spotify and get it for free with ads, and same with Audio, and maybe Deezer, I forget, to be honest, then, you know, in the face of that sort of 7 days free use and then trying to chase people for a $10 or $15 subscription is just you know, it doesn't add up, does it? People are just going to take one look and sort of say, well, you know, as everyone's constantly remarked, you know, these services are largely homogenous, bar a few discovery bits thrown in and stuff like that. But certainly to the degree where, you know, if it's $10 a month on Beats or nothing for Spotify and you put up with some ads, then I would imagine a lot of people will plump for the former. But, yeah. I mean, you know, I think something that others have remarked is that this is all just manna from heaven for Spotify. You know, it thrusts the whole streaming music debate right to the fore.
Right.
You know, it drives a lot of people back their way because of people questioning whether Beats are the ones to go for. You know, it's a total gift. I mean, if I was Spotify, I'd just be running around doing high fives all the time now.
Yeah.
So, I suspect, you know, we'll see. But I think around this, Spotify probably shouldn't get too comfortable because, you know, again, going back to Lucy's point, I think we're still the question that's not been answered is the degree to which streaming services can just be tossed in with something else you're paying for.
Yeah.
Whether that's an iPhone or something a little bit more straightforward, kind of like Amazon Prime, you know, where they're trying to bundle in video now. So originally we were all signing up because it meant free postage, whereas now it's sort of free postage and free video service. And, you know, if they bundle music into that as well, then that would be a pretty aggressive move to the man in the street. And, you know, I think every time I'm on here, I seem to repeat that mantra, but it's kind of like, you know, we in the music industry tend to look at ourselves and our terribly snobbish ways when I think, you know, the other 95% of the population that you're trying to capture on this are probably more likely to go in for bundled services and things because it's just very painless and it reaches that point of sort of music as a, you know, as an amenity service in the same manner as electricity and stuff, you know.
Yeah. And Lucy, from your side, you worked at labels as well, you know, Ministry of Sound and Anjuna Beats. So from with that hat on, how scared do you think labels are of potentially seeing iTunes move away from downloads and into streaming? And how do you think that the transition can be, you know, everybody's wondering how will Apple handle that transition, which is going to come at some point, but could really leave a gaping hole in the music industry's revenues if it happens too quickly?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it is something for all of us to worry about, I think, in the music industry, not just from the label side, but for everybody's side. You know, Mark Monaghan's written some very good pieces about this, that, you know, the decline in CD sales and download sales is not being covered sufficiently by streaming at the moment, that there is a big gap. And just as you said just now, if this happens too fast, you know, we're all going to be in a lot of trouble because streaming as a model, you know, is still not proven. I remember, you know, Chris Cook from CMU was talking about this at the Great Escape last week as well and saying, you know, while there's every reason for optimism, at the same time, we all have to be cautious because about streaming as a model, because the long-term efficacy, you know, isn't proven, and no one knows if it's going to be viable long-term, and if it is, in what format, whether that's, you know, continuous pure play music services, or as we were just talking about, whether it ends up being that in order to really convert the mainstream consumer to music streaming, they do, you know, the big tech giants of the world do end up buying up all the music streaming services. It does end up getting bundled in with, you know, your Amazon Prime and your everything else. So, yeah, I think, you know, we are facing a difficult time, you know, in the sense of the transition between CDs and downloads to streaming and how that's going to go. And no one really has any answers as yet, at least for me, clearly. It's going to be very interesting to see how that all plays out over the next year or two. And I think if Apple do buy Beats, that really is going to, you know, put the cat amongst the pigeons pretty quickly. And I think that could actually set off a chain reaction of, you know, reactions from the other streaming services. And then we may find ourselves in 12 years' time in a situation that's completely different, where the music industry has moved very, very fast from where we are now to potentially a completely different scenario in 12 months' time. From the label side, I guess as well, we always have to consider, you know, the point you were talking about, Andrea, before about the licenses. You know, no one knows whether Apple's going to have to renegotiate the licenses if the purchase does go ahead. We're all assuming that they probably will, you know, and then it's a case of, you know, how much do the major labels want to support Apple in the industry? I think Darren actually raised this point in the Daily Digest. a few days ago, and of course UMG have a huge stake and are set to cash out to a tune of what was it, 442 million I think, if the sale does go ahead. So that's another very interesting point to consider when we're talking about labels and, you know, this possible acquisition of between Apple and Beats.
That's exciting. It's the first time we're going to see like a payout to a major label from a streaming service.
Yeah, and
yes, let the punch up begin.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think Darren raised a really good point about this in the digest again, that you know, that might all reignite the whole debate about, you know, well, okay, UMG are benefiting to the tune of nearly 450 million. So, you know, where's the actual benefit from that coming to the artist? You know, is that going to trickle down and, you know, to the artist, to the labels, primarily the artists, of course. And then, you know, that this could all kick off that debate again about how much artists are actually benefiting from the streaming model.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure this will come up. The first time there's a big payout, this will come up right away.
Yeah.
There's going to have to be like a big artist that decides that they are owed, you know, 2% of that amount, and they're going to start a fight about it. But we'll cross that bridge when we come to it, I guess. So it's a real pleasure to welcome Adam Kidron, the CEO of Yonder. So hi, Adam. Thanks for joining us. How's it going?
Everything's fine here in New York.
It's great to have you. And so essentially, you know, I just wanted to bring you on the show to chat about the company. I read a piece on the New York Times today about it that was written by Ben Cesario. So I just wanted to sort of check in and see what's going on at the company. So what is Yonder all about?
What we're doing is we're introducing a new music model, which we think should become a new category in the marketplace. As you know, there's a great deal of hope at the moment on streaming services, paid for monthly streaming services. And we're of a view that there shouldn't be so much hope about paid for monthly streaming services, because by any measure, they only appeal to a subset of a very small market, the people who want to pay for music. And we calculate that market is about 1% of global mobile users. So if you take Spotify with maybe 7 million paid subscribers, if you count all the people on the free month, Deezer with maybe 5 million, Beats we now know has a princely 117,000. And you add them all up, it comes to about 20 million paid music subscribers in the world.
Right.
And there's 2 billion people on smart devices. So the question is, who's going to appeal to the other 99%?
Sure. And so, And so in that sense, you're looking at what is called a hard bundle, right? About bundling the music with a phone?
With a phone or with service, yes. So, okay. The basic proposition for the consumer is they buy the device they want, they take the service they want, and music and the cost of music is embedded in it. And because we're accessing consumers by the tens of thousands rather than individually, we're able to do it at prices that are almost invisible to consumers.
Right. And so led you to this decision, and was the starting up this new venture sort of informed by the experience you had with Beyond Oblivion as well?
Yeah, I mean, the Beyond Oblivion experience was informed by a royalty statement I got for a record in 2007 called This Is Why I'm Hot, which was the number one record in America, and I got a royalty statement for a few thousand dollars for it. And I realized that the model, the paid download model, wasn't going to work because it wasn't going to throw off enough revenues to build a healthy music industry. So we started Beyond Oblivion, but we started Beyond Oblivion at a difficult time. The record companies were quite resistant to it, wanted very high advances. Now, 4 years later, faced with a very discouraging curve of iTunes revenues and a very even more discouraging curve of paid subscription revenues, you know, it's much easier with the record companies because they realize that at least our service isn't going to cannibalize their existing revenues.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so we haven't seen much in the way of hard bundles since really Nokia comes with music. And so what are you doing differently to Nokia that sort of encourages you to take this path?
Well, first of all, I think that Comes With Music was about 85% right, it was a wonderful example of a great idea sort of ruined in its execution. And I've had a couple of those, so I know how difficult it really is. So I remember going to Carphone Warehouse when Comes With Music came out, and I was really excited. So I said to the salesperson, "So how does this work?" And the lady in the store says, "Well, I'm not 100% sure, but I think you get music free for the first year, and you can only get it on this one device." And she showed me this device, and it was nothing anybody would want to ever buy. And she said, "And at the end of the first year, I'm not really sure what happens. I think you have to pay for it, but I'm not really, really sure." So the issue with Comes With Music was it was a hugely confused marketing message. It was on some really crap phones. And it was at a time where smartphone penetration was actually very, very low. So it was before its time. The other thing is that Nokia had negotiated some really horrendous deals with the music labels that made Comes With Music very, very expensive,
right,
for Nokia. So I think it's just a question of time. You know, I wish I could show you the application. In fact, we should have done this with an Android mirror so we could show you the application, because the application itself is very, very, very elegant.
That's awesome, yeah, and hopefully maybe we can arrange to have you back on the show to do a one-to-one show, and I can actually do live demos via Skype of applications. So that's definitely something I'd like to do at some point. Do you have any questions for Adam before I let him go?
Adam, I'm curious with the current model as it stands. You know, who are your sort of primary targets in terms of partnerships across mobiles then with these devices? Am I understanding you right that, you know, you will partner with current handset manufacturers to be offering this as a complete bundled service?
Yeah, but I think that as you look globally, especially in developing markets, you're looking mostly at actually network operators, because they have huge audiences and they can just deploy it as you want. So hard bundled with service, especially in prepaid low ARPU markets, is probably the way to go. And you'll see some very exciting announcements from us, especially in Africa, Latin America, and developing markets in Asia, all within the next 2 or 3 months. We expect to go to market in Ghana, Nigeria, South Africa, Botswana, Angola, all in between August and September of this year. And so, yes, manufacturers are a target, but eventually we'll probably have our own branded devices. But the truth of the matter is that the real tonnage is in network operators, especially network operators in developing markets.
Right, absolutely. Okay. Lucy, do you have anything to ask? Or?
Yeah, I mean, you touched on marketing just now, Adam, and how Nokia were doing it, and you said that you want to attract sort of the 98% of the market who aren't currently paying for music. So I'm just interested to know what your marketing plans are to kind of help you achieve that goal.
Well, as somebody who's sort of been a bit obsessed by marketing his entire life, in this particular case, the marketing we're doing is going to be mostly in-network. So what we're going to be doing is going with networks that say, look, you know, our network sounds better with unlimited music from Nokia, or manufacturers that say our device sounds better, or unlock unlimited music on your device. So we'll be working with manufacturers who want to show off the capability of their devices, whether it's stereo speakers or compression, or it's the capacity, or a network that's just upgraded to 4G, has limited spectrum, wants a progressive download model because they can serve most of the files locally instead of over the air. You know, so we'll be doing marketing, but we'll be doing marketing to people who mostly have already got the application. So this is a distribution play. You put the application on the handset, you tell people it's the best way of accessing music, you get incredibly high activation rates. And so the marketing is to people already have the application on the device, because what you're trying to do always is prove the value of the hard bundle. So it's a bit of a different proposition. That said, on the 20th of on the 20th of this month. We're going to have a lot of fun in New York City, and I'm sure you'll hear about it in London, because we're going to do something very flash and very, very nice.
Awesome. Nice.
Sounds intriguing.
Adam, that's great. Thanks so much for your time. And what is the website for the company if people want to go and check it out?
www.yondamusic.com.
That's perfect. And thanks so much for your time. And I look forward to hearing more about it in the next few months. I know it's still early stage. And thanks again to Adam for chipping in with the latest from Yonder. And now I want to talk about Kickstarter. And so I want to talk about the Aphex Twin campaign that just finished. So it was a Kickstarter that was deemed as a once in a lifetime chance to own Aphex Twin's unreleased album Caustic Window. The campaign closed having raised $67,424 pledged by 4,124 backers, who paid each $16 each to receive a digital copy of the album. So, a pretty respectable amount there. And Caustic Window was Aphex Twin's first release from 1994, but it never really saw the light of day. Only four people in the world apparently owned the test pressings of the album. So all of them had sworn never to release it. And when a copy turned up on eBay, a fan of Aphex Twin, James E. Thomas, who heads up the site We Are the Music Makers, thought it could be possible to buy it and then convince the label to license it to them for this limited edition run. The cool thing is that it won't go on sale to the general public after this Kickstarter. It will just be distributed digitally to those 4,124 people, and then that will be that, unless somebody puts it on a torrent, of course, which, if they have pledged, it's less likely, I guess, because they'll feel some sort of ownership towards the album and exclusivity. So I wanted to address this story sort of from the angle of how it helps releases that have never seen the light of day, or that have not been released, or catalog releases come back to light thanks to crowdfunding. So Lucy, do you think that there's a big play there? And I know that Pledge, for example, have set up their catalog division to take care of just these projects, but do you think it's still relatively underrepresented, and that it's kind of funny that fans are taking the lead and doing something like this?
Yeah, I think it's particularly applicable for, obviously, catalog releases and for artists who already have, a big fan base. In the case of Aphex Twin, I mean, obviously, it's made even more enticing, I guess, by the fact that, it is so exclusive. It was their very first recording. Only those four people in the world ever had a copy, and it's not being put on general sale afterwards. And, you tend to find on most Kickstarter campaigns, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but, most of them don't have that much kind of excitement around it. They're not so exclusive, they will be going to general sale at some point, or, it's not as enticing as this particular one. So I can see why it's done so well. And I think, in addition, probably the fact that Aphex Twin isn't exactly the kind of artist to be on Facebook, or Instagram showing you what he had for his breakfast every day, that I think that kind of lack of access actually to the artist probably helps in this particular case to make it even more exclusive, even more exciting if you're a fan of Aphex Twin, because you really can't get this kind of content. It really is a complete one-off, and that's very, very exciting. I think there's definitely a time and a place for catalog releases on Kickstarter. If you're an established artist and you already have, a big fan base and there's enough for demand for it, then great. And of course, find out if there is enough demand for it, Kickstarter and Pledge Music, et cetera, is the best way to do that. So that's great. Of course, it's not going to work so well if you're an established artist, but for a catalog campaign, it can be very effective.
Absolutely. And there's still a lot of labels that sort of survive, the smaller labels that survive by finding those hidden gems in Universal Music's catalog or Warner's catalog, going to the archives and asking for a permission to license those recordings and release them to a public that they know is going to be willing to buy them, whilst Universal Music might not have a financial reason really to do that. And so, at least they license it, they get a bit of money off the release, and these other independent smaller labels are able to actually put the albums out. So Darren, do you think this is going to be something that we're going to see more of from a crowdfunding perspective rather than an actual label that is curating this?
Not really, to be honest. I don't know. I mean, I think as Lucy said, it's Aphex Twin. It's his first release. Aphex Twin fans are fucking mental. I mean, someone got buried with his back catalogue, for crying out loud. You know what I mean? It's like that's a next level brand maniac fan.
Right.
And, Yeah, I just think there's a long history of these things happening, isn't there, where someone does, you know, something that's different, innovative, whatever, you know, like Radiohead and the whole In Rainbows stuff and everything else. It doesn't really set a precedent for people doing it. And the minute someone else does it, it kind of fairly instantly loses its kind of gloss, you know, as a proposition. I mean, and I think this one's pretty kind of unique on a number of levels. I mean, they are... you know, Maniac fans, which obviously helps a lot. You know, I think Aphex Twin, it kind of suits Aphex Twin to do it this way. You know, it plays well to his whole mysterious vibe. You know, about the only other artist I could think of that would probably pull this off is something like the KLF.
Right.
And then they'd probably just burn the money afterwards. but, you know, it's sort of, it's just not, you know, I don't think it really... is something to read a great deal into, really.
Incredibly rare circumstance as well. Like, I don't think there's probably you can't probably count on the palm of your hands the bands that have that unreleased album that has never seen the light of day.
Yeah, you can't replicate that scenario for your average artist, I don't think. No. You know, as we've all said, I think it's a really nice way of kind of super serving fans when you have an extreme case scenario like this one. But as Darren was saying, you know, I wouldn't want to see, you know, loads of labels and artists trying to jump on this bandwagon and just do it because it's the next big thing. Yeah. You know, it's not, or at least I hope it's not. You know, it's a great way to super serve the fans for the right artist at the right time with the right release. But, you know, I hope it kind of stays that way and people don't try and jump on the bandwagon.
And you do see in catalog releases now that people are picking at straws these days, because sometimes they've already had one re-release of that a particular classic album come out, and now they just don't know what to do. Like, I'm a big Elton John fan. I'm sure I've been pretty vocal about it before, so I'm not too ashamed about it. But I got the re-release of Goodbye Yellow Brick Road last month, and amazing, you know, remaster, all great, but it had already been remastered, so it's kind of like beyond the point. But it had all these covers made by bands of all kinds of all walks of life, and literally like 95% of them are terrible covers, and it's just, you know, you feel like the label had the pressure of adding something to the package in order to make it more appealing, but it wasn't a very good,
kind of cries out for the Goodbye Yellow Shit Road headline, really, doesn't it?
Exactly. Unfortunately, that was the I was very optimistic. I started listening to the covers with a very open heart and thinking, oh, maybe they did something fantastic. No, it didn't. That's the kind of thing that unfortunately happens a lot with catalog, because people are trying to add value.
There's a good market for this stuff. I mean, you know, I think Soul Jazz and other labels have done, you know, and Trunk and Finders Keepers have done an amazing job of digging up, you know, totally bizarre lost gems. And, you know, the William Onyebor is probably a great example, where Luca Bopp have, you know, pulled out this record by this guy that now every bloody hip artist on the planet is raving about. And, you know, I've had like three separate friends made me go, oh my God, have you heard this? And, you know, this is someone who's been around years. You know, this music is decades old now. So, you know, it's kind of proof that there's always good stuff to pull up. And what's there to pull up, and how applicable it is, changes with culture and movement of the times. But, I mean, you know, on the flip side, Jimmy Page remastering the sodding Led Zeppelin catalogue for, I mean, no joke, it's what, the third or fourth time? I mean, it's just an insult to everybody involved. And, you know, that needs to stop.
Yes.
You know, that's muckraking in the extreme. And, you know, as with your Elton John example, you know, as you say, it's kind of like they're now troweling up songs going, you know, here's something that was never released. And normally it's kind of could be suffixed with yes for a good reason, because it's shite.
Yeah.
So, yes.
It's one of those things.
But, leave those things alone.
And I'd like to take another short break now at this point. We're going to have a 5-minute extract of the interview I recorded yesterday with Bob Barbieri, who is the CEO of Dubset. If you tuned into last week's show recorded at The Great Escape, we actually talked about Dubset and the fact that they just closed a new B round led by Rhapsody. So the full interview will be live on the One-to-One show this week. So if you want to tune into that, please do on digitalmusictrends.com. Otherwise, here is 5 minutes on what the company is all about and why Rhapsody got involved. So hi, Bob. Thanks for joining me on the show today. How's it going?
It's going terrific. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So, of course, last week we covered during the DMT live at The Great Escape the investment round, the B round investment led by Rhapsody. So it would be fantastic if you could start by introducing Dubset as a company to our listeners.
Sure. Dubset was founded in 2009 and is a music technology company. The basis of the company is founded in developing technologies that resolve the rights in complex music content. Complex music content, most often described as mixed content in the DJ world. So the sweet spot for this company is taking essentially a 1 hour mixtape, live performance, radio show, podcast that contains 10, 20, 30 different samples of music, processing that, registering it. So we created this global registry. Once we register and process it through our partnership with Gracenote, we identify all the way down into 3 second audio files what's being played in each 3 second audio file. We then reassemble that into what we call a mixed DNA. Once we have a mixed DNA, that piece of content can now be shared globally with consumers, with data coming back from the distributor as to all of the listener data points. Here's where they started, here's where they stopped, here's where they restarted, fast forward, rewind, and so forth. And because we've parsed these down into 3 second audio files, we can, in a very granular and precise way, provide back exactly what sample tracks in that mix were listened to.
Last week, we were talking about the fact that, you know, the company's got both, of course, a back-end side of it and a front-end, of course, the front-end being the future FM and the back-end being those royalty recognition technologies that you just talked about. And so how much focus is there from the company on the front-end versus the back-end, or do those two sort of go along on a parallel path?
You know, it's a great question. We've put a lot of our energy into the consumer-facing side, the future.fm, simply because we needed to have that in order to build what we call MixBank, which is our artist-facing platform, right, and MixScan, the underlying technology. So we built out this consumer platform. We just launched on May 6th, as you probably have seen, a new UI UX on the web, the new iOS version is coming out in about a week and a half. But we've invested a lot into that and into the MixScan technology that underlies the rights and resolution points. Moving forward, you're going to see more of our development going into MixBank and continue into MixScan, because the future.fm essentially is finished in our world. The DSPs, the Rhapsodies, and other folks have the opportunity to use that as a turnkey platform if they want to put it adjacent or within their service, or they can just offer the music out of their own library.
Yeah.
As if we were provide the future.fm is almost more of a label to them and just providing 100,000 hours of new content to them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And we had a statement from Rhapsody that said, you know, that the investment that they had in this new round of funding sort of demonstrates the commitment of the company to EDM. So in that sense, do you feel like they were interested in the back end side of things, in the future of FM? You know, last week my panelists were talking about the fact that it would be very cool for Rhapsody to be able to integrate some of the content you have on the future onto Rhapsody itself. And so where do you think that interest stemmed from?
Well, you know, Rhapsody is an interesting company, Andrea. They've gone through a lot of changes over the last year for the better.
Yeah.
As you know, they operate under Napster almost everywhere except for the U.S. And they've built some amazing partnerships and relationships with mobile operators like Telefonica and others. And they're arguably now one of the fastest, probably with Spotify, the two fastest growing music services in the world. So they're sort of stepping out of their comfort zone. And this investment in us was, as you saw, first for them. We're working closely with their team. The interesting part of the business for us is, and I come from a technology world where I build these sort of neutral platforms that solve marketplace inefficiencies. There's already been some questions about neutrality with a Rhapsody investment. So sure. It's a minority investment. B, it was a great investment from our part, because now what's the natural extension? Once you have the future.fm all figured out, the natural extension is, okay, now start plugging in music services.
Yeah.
So the Rhapsody service is in the process of plugging in. There's definitely a commitment on their part, Andrea, into EDM dance. And EDM is much, as you know, much broader than just electronic, right? We have a massive amount of pop top 40 mixes that I don't know if the EDM folks would even want classified as EDM.
Right.
But all of that content is very interesting. We have country mixes that are real interesting. And what I think Rhapsody sees, and other music services, we're in discussions or various level of integrations with about 10 other music services right now. What they see is this is an amazing discovery vehicle for music, right? So you get a mix curated by a top DJ in the world. Within that, you hear a track that may be new to you or something that you really like, particularly the way it's mixed. You can click on a button and basically put that individual track into your Rhapsody playlist or into your Rhapsody music library. And that's what's exciting to those folks.
And thanks so much for your time, Bob, today. It was great having you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure joining you.
And again, check out dubset.com for the main company's website, and also check out thefuture.fm for the more consumer-facing part of the company. And this week we had an avalanche of piracy-related stories, but they're not as yawn-inducing as you might think, so stick with us. And I'd like to thank actually Torrent Freak a lot for all the insights on these new developments, because most of the articles I'm drawing these from are from Torrent Freak. And so, first up, Lucy, we're going to talk about Sweden. So it's your part of the world, and I've seen a new study that talks about the effects of the iPred anti-piracy law. You can actually download it if you're interested at home. It's a 21-page document and quite academic, and that is quite yawn-inducing, so you have to have quite a strong stomach to read through all those 21 pages. The law, the iPred law, gives the rights holders the authority to request the personal details of alleged copyright infringers, and has been in place for 5 years now. The researchers write as a summary that we find the reform decreased internet traffic by 16% and increased music sales by 36% during the first six months. Pirated music, therefore, seems to be a strong substitute to legal music in that sense. But they also write that the deterrent effect decreased quickly, possibly because of the few and slow legal processes. The law enforcement through convictions, therefore, seems to be a necessary ingredient for the long-run success of a copyright protection law. So this is a very interesting take on the whole process, because we've been used to hearing about the failures of projects like HADOP, for example, in France, and they pulled the plug on the three strikes in the middle of last year because it wasn't working. And so hearing that it actually worked in Sweden as a deterrent is kind of interesting. So, Lucy, what are your thoughts on that? And do you think that that could have been a reason why, for example, Spotify did so well?
Possibly. I mean, I have to confess, I haven't read through the 21 pages. No, I can't lie.
Me neither.
I've only read the Torrent Freak piece.
I skimmed it.
Which is sort of summarizing it. You know, clearly that's my bedtime reading for tonight, is these 21 pages. I mean, it's hard to say, to be honest, without reading the full report. It's the Torrent Freak article is kind of saying, literally as soon as, you know, the day that this law came into effect, then, you know, internet traffic dropped hugely, you know, piracy, you know, there was a significant drop in internet traffic, and it improved music sales, and et cetera, but there's no, they don't kind of factor into this piece kind of, you know, the effect on streaming. And, you know, yeah, Spotify in particular, I think, have done some good PR around that, you know, how much their service has done, you know, to improve piracy and you know, to a certain extent, get rid of it, you know, in countries like Sweden and Norway when it comes to music.
Yeah.
This article is kind of, it's just giving me a very incomplete picture, yeah, I find, and I'm just reading, I'm slightly dubious, to be honest, about, you know, suddenly there'd be a huge drop in internet traffic on the same day that it came into effect, because, you know, I mean, most of the time, you know, reading the other Torrent Freak pieces around kind of Hadopi and the plans for the UK to bring in new laws, you know, they're just not very effective, usually, I find, these,
exactly,
laws.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly in deterring people, because, you know, just reading the plans for the UK, you know, you're going to get four warnings. After four warnings, you're not going to get another one, and basically no action is really going to be taken. So, you know, how much of a deterrent can that possibly be, you know? And I have to say, I think in Sweden, generally speaking, I'm going to brace myself for a load of abuse from angry Swedes after this, but to be honest, piracy is quite well ingrained here.
Right.
And I would be very surprised about there being really a direct correlation between a law coming into effect in one day and a sudden huge drop in internet traffic on the same day because people think, oh, there's a new law just being passed. Okay, exactly. No, I won't download the new Game of Thrones. Okay, Game of Thrones being aired 5 years ago, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, sure. And I mean, that's exactly what I was going to ask. It was culturally like, it's not that different from the UK that people would actually literally, you know, stop the presses and stop doing what they're doing because the new laws come into place. Okay, right.
No, really. I mean, piracy really is pretty well ingrained here. I think in terms of music, it is fair to say that Spotify, you know, and maybe to a lesser extent services, local services like Wimp, etc., have done a lot to improve that situation. I think in terms of sort of downloading, you know, films, TV shows, that kind of thing, particularly where you can't get popular shows like Game of Thrones and things, you know, that's still quite... quite well ingrained, I think, yeah. in the popular culture in Sweden, and I'm very dubious about there being, you know, correlation between this law being passed and a sudden huge drop in piracy and an increase in music sales. I just don't think that was the case. I think
I would love to know if there was
Spotify have done more than anyone else, you know, to sort out the situation with piracy here and get much, you know, many more people paying for music. I think that's really what's improved over the last few years, not that people have been deterred by this law, to be honest.
I wonder if the people that have compiled the study have actually got in touch with the VPN providers and found a huge spike in VPN adoption by Swedes.
Yeah, I'd be surprised, to be honest. I really wouldn't, because of course there is an availability issue here, you know, in terms of not being able to get content that's readily available in the UK and the USA and things, and it is very frustrating. And you know, a lot of the time people do have to resort to, you know, proxies and VPNs and things if you want to get international content.
Yeah.
So yeah, that is an issue, definitely.
Yeah. And Darren, I want to ask about the UK, because there was another story on the UK, the fact that the four biggest ISPs, including Virgin Media, TalkTalk, BT and Sky, are in talks with the content owners to start issuing letters to the customers if they are detected downloading illegal or copyrighted content. So this really strikes me as a deja vu. I was kind of checking the calendar to see if I was transported back to 2011 or 2012, but I am in 2014. So I wanted to ask you, you know, why now? It's, you know, at a time where it seems like hitting the wallets of pirates is really the way to go and trying to stop their advertising revenues. Why would we start again with an expensive and ineffective avenue of going and writing letters to consumers?
I mean, I find it hard not to be incredibly cynical and probably supply an answer to the tune of, you know, because the government are leaning on the ISPs and the ISPs need to tick a box,
right,
that makes the government leave them alone. You know, they've come under huge pressure. There's been a kind of do it or we'll legislate it type approach, which the ISPs are probably not in favour of. But it's a bit ludicrous, really, isn't it? I mean, the sort of, you know, as Lucy said, it's like, you know, what, four letters and then they tell your mum? I mean, for crying out loud. You know, this is ridiculous. And, you know, I think history, if it's taught us anything, has certainly taught us that, you know, crackdowns on piracy just lead to developers really biting down on finding ways to circumvent the crackdown. So, you know, there is always...
like popcorn time.
Yeah, you know, these things always come along that are just going to totally screw that up. So in that respect, I find it very hard to sort of believe that this is going to do anything at all. And it just raises this question. I mean, you know, Martin Mills touched on it, and you know, in this speech he did this week about, you know, cracking down on Google and the notion that sort of a takedown should be a stay down. And I think that's kind of much more of a pertinent question than this kind of middle ground of ISPs mailing people sort of saying, hey, man, what you're doing is like totally wrong. And the guy just being like, yeah, I don't care. I knew that anyway. Like, we're not stupid. We know when we're pirating that you're downloading something illegally. It's just we also know that the consequences of it are at best, well, evidently now, a harshly worded letter in a true British style. So it feels more like people ticking boxes to make other people feel that they're doing something. You know, I think if they were truly cracking down on things like this, the ISPs that are currently the lesser ones that maybe don't get all over this as much will suddenly find they get a surge on business. Because certainly, you know, It's the reason I switched from Plusnet to Zen, for example, was Plusnet kept shaping traffic. And I, whilst I'm not, you know, a huge consumer of pirated content, it's kind of like I don't appreciate the notion that an ISP is going to dictate what traffic is, you know, like primary traffic for me.
Yeah.
And so I didn't like the way that they did that. So I moved to Zen, where they don't have any traffic shaping or any of that stuff at all, you know. And so as a consumer, it was my right to do that. And that's what I exercised, you know, my right, you know, then moved over. So I just feel that if the ISPs were going to be that silly about it, all you'd see is people just going, well, all right, I'll be off over here then.
Yeah.
So I just, the whole thing just smacks of being painfully ineffective, and they're talking to the ISPs when they need to really be talking to Google and the people that are the connective tissue here, not the conduit down which the pirate content flows.
Yeah, and you know, you touched upon the speech that Martin Mills did from the Baggers Group, and this was done at Canadian Music Week, and it's actually reproduced in full on musictechpolicy.wordpress.com. If anybody in the audience wants to go and check it out, it's definitely worth a read. A couple of main sort of takeouts from it is essentially pointing out the abuse of the safe harbors and the DMCA by companies like Google and YouTube. So interesting, actually, that he should use YouTube and Grooveshark in the same sentence. That was quite, disruptive thing to do, because, of course, Grooveshark has got a lot of more issues than YouTube right now when it comes to getting rights. But, it, you know, he talked about the fact that there's an imbalance here as to where the burden lies on the DMCA point of view. And this kind of ties into the Haddo P, which is the last piracy story that I was going to talk about. So Haddo P, of course, has been stopped as a law itself, but the Haddo P agency still exists, and so they've compiled a report on a development tool to deal with piracy, and one of those recommendation actually is altering the DMCA style process, which also happens in Europe, where our record labels would have to request for the takedown of the same tracks millions of times to the same provider, and you know, in their eyes it should work, and in the US they would like that to be changed as well. They would like to be able to, for example, take down Katy Perry's Firework once, and that'd be that. And, you know, that, you know, YouTube, for example, or Grooveshark would be able to just keep that track down without having to keep sending those notices. So, the Haddo P also made a couple of other recommendations, which was creating a public list of shames or services that are infringing on copyright on a large scale. And also they were talking about hitting the advertising side of things for pirate sites and restricting their access to advertising inventory, essentially. So on that front, do you think that it is time? You know, we know that in the US there is a copyright reviewing process, and the DMCA is going to be part of that conversation. How hard do you think that there's going to be lobbies on both sides trying to get things staying as they are or change for the better for the content industries? Lucy, do you have any ideas to, you know, well, not an idea, but can you picture what kind of wars are going on at the back of?
I don't know if I want to be honest. I think it's going to get quite ugly quite fast.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, just going back to what you're saying about the Haddo P article and the agency and what they're trying to do. I mean, to be honest, it sounds like they're the most effective ones, if you like, kind of more effective than this law in Sweden. It certainly sounds like what they're trying to do is, you know, stands a chance of being more effective than these, you know, like Sarah was saying, yeah, forewarnings and then we'll call your mum type approach in the UK.
It's amazing as well. It's like, wow, Haddo P is seeing the light. What's going on?
But reading the article, though, you're saying, you know, if you could order a takedown notice, it actually was also a stay down notice, like Martin Mills was touching on in his speech. You know, it still says, you know, these kinds of orders could be valid for up to 6 months, you know, but then not, it's still not for any longer than that. And then it says it's also, that would only be initially be applicable to sites that are hosting files and not links to files. So, you know, BitTorrent indexes or something like that. You know, the the end of the report says, these are all responses gradually leading to establishment of an effective action against websites taking advantage of a massive operation of counterfeiting. I mean, you know, you just read that paragraph and think, oh, you know, that just sounds like such a load of fluff, to be honest. I mean, it's just like, oh, these are all gradually leading to some effective action of some kind, but we don't really know what. I mean, you know, could you really get more of a fudge?
Yeah.
It's clearly a very delicate and very difficult situation. And, you know, of course, if it wasn't so difficult, someone would have found a solution by now. But, you know, I just don't feel like any of these agencies are really producing any effective action whatsoever at the moment. And I want to actually touch on something that Darren, again, raised excellently in the Digest a few days ago, which was... that Duncan Gear had sent him an article about the availability of content, because Martin Mills was kind of saying, you know, Google said that it's an availability issue and a pricing issue, and I think that's absolute rubbish. You know, it might have been true 10 years ago or whatever, but, you know, today you just can't really get away with that statement. And then the article that Duncan sent was actually kind of suggesting that, in fact, perhaps availability, you know, and pricing is still a big issue and more of an issue than you might think. I mean, I definitely think it is, you know, just to bring it back to Game of Thrones, sorry, not that I'm obsessed or a mad fan or anything, but, you know, I mean, it's ridiculous. There was that excellent cartoon on, what was it, The Oatmeal or The Onion or something, I think it was last year, just showing how no matter how hard you tried to legally get your hands on the latest episode of Game of Thrones, you just can't do it. You know, they don't even bring out the DVDs of the show until, you know, a year after the previous season has aired. I mean, it's madness. It's complete madness. You know, I think music streaming services are getting better in this respect, but I think the film industry and the TV industries still have an awful long way to go in terms of, you know, sorting out the availability and pricing. And, you know, why don't you just make Game of Thrones available worldwide, you know, as soon as it airs, you know, and then people can subscribe to the service, they can watch it straight away, they won't feel the need to go to the Pirate Bay or whatever it is they use to download episodes illegally. You know, I would pay more for a legal streaming subscription service on a monthly basis if I knew that I would be able to have all of the content that I wanted to.
Yeah.
And I'm still constantly frustrated every time I go on Netflix or something similar. You know, almost every time I look for a show or a movie or whatever I want, it's not there. You know, it's very, very frustrating. So, you know, I think Martin Mills is right that it's not enough for Google or YouTube to just say, oh, well, you know, it's a bit of an availability problem or whatever. But it is still an issue, a big issue, yeah. And particularly for film and TV. And you know, the studios and the music publishers and everyone, you know, people have got to wake up to this. We've got to sort it out. You know, digital copyright just, you know, it's still analog, really. We're still stuck in an analog age, yeah. I feel, you know. You know, we've got to bring things up to date and get into the 21st century.
And unfortunately, yeah, it's always the highest bidder thing, right? So if the producers of Game of Thrones know that they're going to get X amount of million from cable networks to broadcast it and keep it windowed and keep it closed, then they're going to keep doing that, just as Beyoncé has released the album just on iTunes and it's not available anywhere else. It's kind of, in a sense, it's, you know, who pays the most and who can you get the most money from, which is I mean, and that's what they think, I guess, because that's a safe bet, but because, you know, nobody of a certain stature has actually tried to do what you were suggesting, Lucy, which is actually going out there and saying, well, actually we're going to make it available worldwide and see who pays what and what happens. This is just too big of a risk for them right now.
Which I understand, but as playing devil's advocate, you have to wonder how much more could you potentially stand to earn if you did make it available, you know.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
Absolutely. And I wanted to close. Well, there's a couple of things that I want to touch upon, but let me choose one. I guess I'm going to finish by talking about this story that came out on Music Ally this morning, which was the fact that Spotify was in talks with CBS to acquire Last.fm before it made a bid for The Echo Nest. I mean, this kind of doesn't come like as a real surprise to any of us. And also, you know, the fact that the price was deemed too high by Spotify comes as no surprise as well, because CBS acquired Last.fm in 2007 for $280 million, and I would imagine they would have been pretty upset if they've been offered the same as the Iconest, so the rumored $100 million, but mostly in virtual Spotify stock instead of actual cash. You know, it would have been a pretty big write off for CBS to take in the sale of Last.fm. So clearly that would have been a great fit for everybody involved. It would have been a great sale, but it didn't happen. So now what next for Last.fm, and who do you think might be interested in buying the company? Darren?
What's next for Last.fm? Honestly, a slow, dwindling, horrible, ignominious death. That's what Last.fm's got rolled up, I'm sure, unless someone comes and bails them out. And I'll say the same thing I say every time when this topic comes up. You know, Last.fm is full of extremely clever, savvy, brilliant people. It's just owned by the wrong company.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very sad, I think, that Last.fm may well find itself as a sort of case study in history of, you know, what happens when a tech company is bought out by a sort of multi, well, just a large corporate entity who only sees the short-term gain in the ad revenue. And I think really that's the thing, is Last.fm's just being kind of bled dry as an advertising cash cow in the same manner as MySpace was. Mm-hmm. And at some point it will just die.
Yeah.
And, you know, and particularly now that Spotify has, bought Echo Nest and everything else, it's, you know, it's going to dwindle in relevance. And, you know, I mean, I said all this before when Last.fm kind of announced they were turning off the streaming side of their product or whatever it was they were doing. And it's quite funny because whenever I give Last.fm or specifically CBS quite a sound kicking, you get a sort of combination of former Last.fm employees emailing me going, right on! And current Last.fm employees going, it's a bit harsh. you know, though not necessarily disagreeing with me, quite tellingly. So more than anything, you know, for all the bile and sort of anger that I've directed CBS's way, more than anything, I just feel terribly sad for the people that are there. And indeed the people that are no longer there. But, you know, at one point, Last.fm was full of really sharp people who could have just done so much with it. It's probably public knowledge, but, you know, there was talk of me going there at one point, and I wanted to go there because the team there were fantastic. I'm not a disgruntled, didn't get the job guy, by the way. It's fine. It was kind of like, it was one of them things. But, I just find it incredibly sad. I mean, I suppose the precursor to the CBS Last.fm thing was sort of Yahoo and Flickr, maybe.
Yeah.
But, and eventually Yahoo kind of got their finger out and turned Flickr around when I think Yahoo realized that they had to buy lots of other companies to exist. And a bit like Facebook's doing now, I think they're realizing that maybe the future lies in a kind of an ecosystem of, you know, separate services rather than one big service to swallow the globe. And
CBS was never desperate.
No, and I think that's the other problem, is CBS probably don't really look at Last.fm as something they need to take action on.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't think they're sat there thinking, Christ, we're losing money hand over fist. What can we get rid of to shore up things or anything else? So it's just sort of owned by this very wealthy company that it just feels like they don't really care.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very unloved entity at the moment. And you know, as I said, more than anything, I just find that very, very sad. I mean, I heard whispers at one point that there was talk of like people trying to almost, you know, affect a people's buyout of Last.fm. And I did hear the numbers going around on that, and I'm not going to divulge them because someone could probably sue me, but they sure as hell weren't high, and they sure as hell weren't what Spotify paid for the Echo Nest.
Yeah.
So who knows? But
who knows?
What a way to go, you know? It's just sad. I feel just horribly sad about the whole thing. CBS took an amazingly good thing and fucking ruined it.
I know, but at the same time, it's one of those things, you know, at the time when it happened, 2007, there was still probably a notion that CBS would turn around and become this sort of media conglomerate that was going to be all funky and sort of take from Last.fm and sort of shape the company around that or something like that. I don't know what they were thinking, but it's a bit like when Vivendi bought mp3.com for 260 million. back in 2003. You know, it's crazy deals.
Yeah, there were strange times, that's for sure. Yeah, but that's the other thing, isn't it? It's sort of, they were bought at that peak sell point and then everything kind of fell apart thereafter, you know. And,
exactly.
But CBS aren't an innovator, you know, they don't do very interesting things across the board. They're quite safe, they're quite old school in the other stuff they own. And, you know, yeah, I just... I'll be interested to read the Music Ally article, because obviously the piece that's on their website today is kind of an excerpt from a longer piece.
Yeah, yeah.
Piece that I'm really keen to read, just because it does sort of ask the question, you know, what could Last FM have been? Where were the opportunities? And kind of what happened, you know? And I mean, I suppose we know what happened in the sense of CBS buying it and letting it sort of slowly fade from view. But
Lucy, are you like me that are sort of slightly worried about all the data that they have about my music consumption and what's going to happen to it?
Well, I've actually never really been a big Last FM user, so I'm fine. Well, I don't know about you.
No problem. Excellent.
But I'm all good.
and
that's the good news for today.
And from your side, who do you think, because we haven't really seen another service come in and do exactly what they do quite as well as they do. So Lucy, do you think there is a need of somebody to be tracking what you're doing online with your music, or are we at the point where this is no longer necessary?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if anyone could do what they do as well as they have done, you know, and I don't know if that is strictly necessary now. I think, you know, it's probably more necessary for services like Spotify to buy services like Echo Nest, you know, so that they can just sort of pump up their data, really, and get as much visibility and data on users' listening and habits, and use that to drive activation and growth as much as they can.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, I just... in all honesty, I've never felt the need personally to use Last FM and to you know, have all my listens scrubbled and whatever, to be honest. I'm not sure why that is. It just, yeah, it's never
thing,
been
right?
a service
yeah.
that's actually felt like it needed a place in my life, to be honest.
Absolutely,
and yeah, I have to say, I don't, you know, with the way that, you know, music technology is evolving now, I don't know that there will ever be another time and place for a service quite like Last FM.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I think it's interesting to me, because I think Last FM never quite fulfilled on its prospect, which was that, you know, it should have been the equivalent of Facebook Connect. There should have been a Last FM Connect that could have plugged in and tailored your experience around music on the internet, in that it could have, you know, ensured that you visit the NME and only see stories about bands that, you know, are generally in your musical graph, if you like, and things like that, you know, and same with apps and everything else. It could have turned into something monumental, but was never really given that opportunity. And another angle, I have to say that as a guy running a marketing company, is like, Last FM still is a phenomenal source for advertisers to find connected artists. You know, if I want to do an ad campaign around my bands, looking at Last FM's data as regards, you know, if person listens to band X, what other bands do they listen to? Last FM's got an absolutely insane amount of insight on that. And for years, it was like, you know, me and about three other ad agencies I knew were just bleeding that bloody API dry for this stuff, because you could go feed it one band, and what it gave you back wasn't an opinion, because when you're doing advertising and you go to any band and say, who do you sound like? The answer you get back is usually not particularly similar to the reality of it, because they're just too close, you know, they see it differently. Whereas Last FM was the reality of it, and sometimes that didn't give you a fashionable answer. You know, it turns out that half your fans also listen to Keane and Coldplay, but that was the fact of it. So if you targeted Keane and Coldplay fans, telling them about this release, you might, you know, get a good response. And, you know, that kind of insight, given that Last FM was a separate entity and wasn't just bundled in with Spotify or whatever, you know, will be lost if Last FM disappears. And I think that, you know, that kind of insight is also going to be a real shame to lose. But ultimately, I think these things are just kind of the ebb and flow of trend, you know, and we probably will reach a point where they'll just, you know, these sorts of things will get bundled in. And then in 5 years, someone will come along with something that basically looks extremely like Last FM, but just looks nicer, feels a bit better, is all a bit more minimal and clean and everything else. And people will probably be all over it, in the same manner that you know, peel back 10 years and someone launched Napster going, well, you can rent your music and stream it when you like, but you don't own it. And everyone was affronted and no one used it. And then Spotify comes along and everyone's like, wow, who knew? You can rent music and you don't, you know. So all these things just go full circle. And I'm sure at some point a service akin to Last.fm may yet prove its value, but right here
unless Spotify take over the world with their platform play, and then everywhere you go on the internet you're going to have Spotify plays buttons, which is a little scary.
Yes, but as we touched on earlier, it's kind of like, you know, Spotify's place in the world is dominant for now,
yeah,
but is by no means unassailable,
because if Apple had wanted to buy it, you know, the rumor was that, you know, with a probably 12 to 15 billion they could have probably easily bought Spotify, which is actually only about 10% of Apple's cash reserves. So if they had wanted to make that move, they could have made that move. And we'll see if anybody else decides to make it or go that way. That would be quite fun. But
it'd be an IPO, from what I understand. My sources, Andrea, nudge, wink, I have sources. They told me that Daniel Ek would kind of rather die than just sell the company.
Sell the company, yeah, yeah. That's what it feels like. Yeah, exactly. And we were talking a couple of weeks ago when Deezer's CEO said he was going to step down in September about the fact that it's a very different type of CEO, because, of course, he didn't found Deezer. And whilst Daniel Ek is very, very much close to Spotify. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to finish, guys. Thanks so much for your time. And I know we've run over a little bit, so just wanted to do a quick roundup of the short and brief news. So the Gramophone project has reached its goal on Kickstarter. It's going to end in a few hours and closing in on about $300,000, with 4,500 people pledging for some sort of device from them. So we'll see how that works, and hopefully I'll have a demo unit in a few weeks to show you. I was one of the first 400 to pledge for it, so hopefully I'll have a review unit that I can.
What's that unit? What does it do?
The Gramophone. It's a bit like a Sonos without speakers, in a sense. Mm-hmm. I think that's a concept.
Is it that sort of rock-looking one? There's one that looks a bit like a sort of...
No, it looks like an Apple TV, essentially, a little bit.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
That's the one made by the Phone. So it's essentially a Phone router plus a music streaming device. Gotcha. On top of that. And the other thing that I wanted to mention is that Spotify overhauled its Windows Phone app. So if you are on Windows phones, the millions of you, I can see my stats that there's about probably 5 people that use Windows phones in the DMT listening community. But if you are, then you can go and get that. But it's only for premium subscribers, so that's a bit of a shame. And excuse me. And finally, Sonos has released its 5.0 app for iOS, which brings Google Play Music, Google Play Music, Beats Music, MBL, Shuffler, FM in the fold, as well as a bunch of new features, including universal search and an alarm clock, which you can choose a track from any service and it's going to wake you up in the morning. So that's pretty cool. And that's pretty much all for this week. So Lucy, thanks so much for joining us on the show today. It was a real pleasure having you on.
Yeah, thanks, Andrea. It was great to be back and great fun as always.
Thanks so much. And thanks, Darren, again. It was a pleasure as always.
Thanks. Sorry about the swearing.
Don't worry about that. We had some swearing at the panel last week as well. And thanks so much for listening to the show this week. And you can find everything on digitalmusictrends.com. Subscribe to the newsletter. You can do all sorts of things. You can subscribe to the actual podcast on a podcast app, which is probably the easiest way to get hold of it every week. And follow us on Twitter on @DigiMusicTrends. I really hope you have a fantastic week. And till next time.